So, welcome to aspect-oriented programming. The key thing that we were concerned about in the second part of the lecture was kind of giving how you can give structure to your programming, how you can kind of come up with modules and keep different concerns apart from each other. So this concept of a module in your software was one of the key components in the last few lectures, and that's one of the concepts that might kind of collide with the things that we will see today. So what is the goal for today? We'll talk about what aspect-oriented programming is, what is weaving, what is advices, what is point cuts, what is join points, and kind of come up with a motivation for why there's something new. We will talk a little bit about the details on what you can actually specify with this kind of means. And also we will talk about how one of these systems, we're going to talk about AspectJ in detail, and we're going to talk about how the AspectJ Weaver actually works and how it includes all these fuss about advices and aspects into your plain old Java classes. Okay, so that's what we're going to do today. So, first of all, the thing about aspect-oriented programming, where does it come from? Well, in the traditional approaches to object-oriented software development, you've seen a lot of approaches that incorporate some kind of class definition as the basic component for a module. And that's what we focused on with traits, with mix-ins, with multiple inheritance. All these kind of methods were centric on the data structure. The problem is not all the things that are conceptually related to each other are actually located in one single particular module at some for some special cases. Imagine, for example, you have something like a tree implementation where you want to get the depth, the maximum depth of the tree, for example. In these cases, you would distribute, for example, something like a recursive function over all the components that this tree is made up from, and place something that counts or increases the depth counter and manages the different branches for you. And you would kind of distribute this particular concern of yours throughout all the different components of your class structure or module structure. And that's something where one concern is actually not centered in one module. You have alternatives for that. There's ideas for something like a generic walk through the whole tree, which you can parameterize with kind of callbacks, so that you can get the callbacks to be in one class, for example. But that needs you to open your data structure for external access at some point, and that's something that you also need to take care of. The other thing is that you need to initially plan for any kind of visitor or callbacks to be included afterwards in your thing. And yeah, that's a little bit tricky to get all these kind of predictions at the first time. So that's probably something that's not so clean to use. So there's a lot of lot of code that is actually conceptually belonging together, that is with standard approaches, is kind of smeared over your class structure, over your object relations, and smeared over your modules. And that's something that we call tangling of aspects. And the main reason to start with something like aspect-oriented programming is that there's with traditional approaches, the focus on aspects of concern that actually belong together logically, that cannot be left to only one module, is something that is not so easily done with common approaches, and that's what aspect-oriented programming is all about, or should be all about. The key term that is in the room for that is something like the cross-cutting of modules. A concern that is cross-cutting several modules is something that is a typical concern that needs to be tackled with aspect-oriented programming. The idea is to specify this this concern completely free of the constraints that traditional modules impose on you, and weave them afterwards into your standard modules. So, yeah, that is the kind of way that standard functional decomposition works. You compose your things into models, and the compiler integrates them into an executable where you can find another represent a clear one-to-one correspondence between the modules in your target and the modules in your specification. So what is different with aspect-oriented decomposition is the thing that you specify your aspects, and then they're kind of going through a special component that is called the weaver, the aspect weaver, and this one is, I hope you can see that on the slide, this one is responsible for mixing these different aspects together so that you get a whole binary where at the parts where you need to have special treatment, aspects of different sources are woven together. So that's the blue here, and this would be the green. So aspects are kind of entangled with each other. They mix with standard things. So that is the rough idea of the whole approach. So there's no clear correspondence between modules in on the specification level to the modules on the target level. What are typical applications for these for this kind of an approach? Well, things that we have seen being implemented with aspects are, for example, security concerns. That was one prominent paper was, for example, about getting rid of SQL injection by using aspect-oriented programming. The idea was to generally catch every location in the program where we get a string from an unknown source and forward it to an SQL statement, and we would intervene in this case and try to escape everything that is kind of malicious for SQL statements. So that is one thing that was very popular usage for aspect-oriented programming. Another thing is, for example, logging. Anyone that has who has already taken part in large-scale software development probably knows about these kind of logging managers where you always post your log messages too, and there's a lot of different logging levels, so you can be pretty detailed about what is happening in your program, with the drawback that you clutter your whole algorithm or code with a lot of logging messages that make it just look really ugly, and probably also increases the difficulty in debugging the whole thing, because it's just so blown with logging statements. So extracting them from or keeping your algorithms clean of any logging messages and keeping them in a different concern, in a different aspect, and just weave them in afterwards is one of the ways to get rid of a lot of these logging messages. Other typical things are validation of forms, error handling, or even profiling. So you would kind of insert some kind of counters or memory related statements into your standard object oriented project. That's something where also aspect oriented programming can shine. So we will now have a look at one of the approaches for aspect oriented programming, and the things that we're used to is Java and C. We're going to have a look at one of these, and that's aspect oriented programming for Java with AspectJ. Has any one of you already worked with AspectJ at one point or another? Or any other aspect-oriented engine? No? Okay, so it's completely new for you. So we're going to start with static cross-cutting. Cross-cutting is something that you might remember from the introduction. That is stating properties on concerns that are distributed over several modules. So that is kind of the cross-cutting aspect of the whole thing. And the other word that is important here is static. So that is things that have nothing to do with runtime properties that can be done completely at compile time. And what is meant by that is largely adding external definitions. So with something like AspectJ, you get the means to alter the definition of standard objects or structures from an external point of view. What does that mean? Well, consider the following example. This is the part that is pretty standard for old-style object-oriented code. We have a kind of a tree structure. It's the structure of expressions, and we have some concrete expressions. Expressions can be constants or add expressions. And basically, what is happening here is there's a tree that is implementable with this, and this tree features leaves that are constants and intermediate nodes that are expressions. So there's just attributes and constructors in there. And now what comes new with aspect-oriented programming is the definition of an aspect. The aspect is something that that gathers something that is cross-cutting the expression tree. And what is done here is kind of a centralized version of the definition of a recursive function. I've told you about this idea of using recursive function calls to compute the maximum depth of a tree. In this case, what we do is we evaluate the expression that is given by this addition expressions on constants in a very easy way. At first, we define that there is an abstract signature that is called eval that returns an integer in every expression. Then we let's probably have a look at the main component that is here, that is the specifier for where this this function definition or specification should go. And in the code that gets generated from, or that is generated by the AspectJ system, the eval now goes at the location where this special identifier was pointing to. So it's the expression. And there's other things that are added by the aspect. There's two concrete implementations for eval, and they're going into constant and add. And what they do is, well, the eval on the constant just returns the constant's value, and the adds eval will just add the evaluations of the two children. So what we end up with is the recursive methods on constant expressions. So that's kind of a convenient way to keep book of your recursive methods and polymorphic trees and data structures. So yeah, so far for these external definitions, but there's not too much really spectacular going on there. It's just one way of adding something that was not planned before in the Java system. So the right part is the one that is generated by the aspect weaver. That's the pink mark code, and the gray one is the one how you would specify it, of course. Well, it has only been in the beginning that the aspect compilers have actually generated source code. Meanwhile, there are more elaborated ways of hooking into external code, especially bytecode rewriting or class load time rewriting. So, yeah, that's where all the magic happens nowadays. So, yeah, that's your external definitions for you. And let's head on straight to dynamic cross-cutting, because that's something that is definitely more challenging. So what comes additionally to before, that is this dynamic aspect of the whole thing. So everything that we will treat now will be about things that occur at runtime. So dynamic cross-cutting is something that is deeply related to the way how a program runs. And the central thing for dynamic cross-cutting is kind of the existence of so-called join points. Join points are points in the program where something special happens, and you can specify, you have special kinds of points that are kind of interceptable. That means where you can hook in and do something to extend the functionality of this running program. So what are join points in the context of seems like there's a lot of exams or something going on now. Okay. So have fun with that. You have got a recording for afterwards. So, there's certain points that can be accessed via AspectJ. And these are, for example, I haven't included all of the join points here on this slide, but at least the ones that are the major join points. If you're interested in the details, you should probably look up the related documentation. So typical join points are the call sites for constructors or methods. So every time that you intend to call and are still in the with your control flow, you are still in the caller or calling body, then we have the method call or constructor call join point active at the moment. Then there's also a join point for the method of constructor execution. That means the control flow has now left the calling site and is now at the beginning of the called method. So the control flow will be somewhere in the or after the prefix of this method, so that at the very first statement of the called method. Yeah, other join points are field related, so each time that you get a certain value of a field or set anew the value of a field, this is also a valid join point. Then there's join point for when an exception has occurred, when the corresponding exception handler is executed, then just at the very start of the exception handler, you also have defined a join point where you can intervene. Then there's join points for class initialization or object initialization. So these are the last two. So these are typical join points. You see that most of them are kind of method related. So yeah, that's something that's suited getting a hook into your program, because you can kind of rewrite the method calls to some kind of trampoline that leads to your own code and then go back to the original call. So that's why all these join points are kind of method related, with one exception, that is these field related things. But you also have to keep in mind that all the field gets and set operations are operations that might be replaced with just getter and setter methods globally throughout the whole program. And if you do so, you have a new method introduced there, which you can intercept with the ordinary means that you have for method join points. So that's actually what's happening under the hood for field gets and sets. So that is typical join points. And every time that the control flow reaches one of these situations, we have kind of reached this join point. Opposite to the join points are the so-called point cuts. And the point cuts are kind of the thing, the means for you to access the join points. You have the possibility to specify with a point cut designator a set or even a singleton set, meaning one particular join point in your program that you might want to have access to. So on one side you have join points. These are all possible points where you can intervene in your program. And then there's means for you to specify which of these join points you actually want to select for intervening. And it's important what you can express with point cut designators. And for these, you have a kind of mini language in AspectJ. So user-defined point cut is defined with the keyword point cut. Then you give it an ID with which you want to access these kind of point cut designators later on. Then you have once again syntax, which is two braces. In these two braces, we might have an identifier list, or we even might not have one. Then there's a colon. And then there's something that I call expression here. This expression is Boolean expressions on primitive point cut designators, which are which are special expressions that match certain join points. We will talk about them on the next slides. So the important thing that you have to keep in mind here is that you can specify point cuts, you give them a certain name that is specified with the identifier here, and then you you give it a meaning by specifying expressions, and these expressions can, are actually Boolean expressions of certain pattern expressions, which are called these special primitive designators. An example looks like the one that you see below. So we define a point cut with the name depth first search, and this point cut is actually meant to be triggered when control reaches the execution of a certain method called DFS on the tree, on objects of class tree, or executions of the DFS method on objects of type leaf. So what you have specified here is kind of callbacks for the execution of DFS thing. DFS thing already kind of hints that there's kind of a depth first search happening on the original program, and what you do with this point cut is you hook into the execution of the particular depth first search incarnations, executions. Okay, so that's an example point cut. So with point cuts, you have a language to specify which of the join points you want to hook into. Now, the only thing that you need now is kind of a way to specify what you want to do when you have, when control has reached one of the join points that you have specified with your point cut. That's what an advice is for. So advices are the a specification of the callback method for the situation that you have specified with your point cut designator. And advice is specified with well, needs to be introduced at first with a specifier of where in relation to the actual join point you want your callback to be executed. So it is initially you need to say whether you want to execute your advice before a special point cut is matched with a join point or is matching the join point, or after the point cut has matched the join point, or yeah, you can filter a little bit more in the case of an after, depending on whether the method inside this point cut specification is actually leaving through an ordinary return statement or a throw statement. I think you need an example now, so I've integrated one here. So we can specify, for example, an aspect doubler, that is the aspect that will, yeah, at the moment it does not do too much, but it will be later on that we will double things that are related to a certain pattern of method calls. We can now specify an advice, and we want to execute this advice before a certain point cut is actually happen, a special join point is actually happen, and this, the join point that we want to hook into before are the ones that we specify with a certain point cut. In this case, I haven't bothered with introducing a separate point cut designator, and, or not a named one, because of space reasons here. So I've inlined the point cut and left out this special syntax from the slide before, but you can also directly work with the expressions that that make up a point cut. So we will want to hook into call sites of the form, well, where the called method is the called foo, and is a method that belongs to receiver of type C and gets an integer as parameter and yields another integer as its result. So that is the type of call sites that we want to match with this advice. And we want to hook in just before the call site is actually reached in our control flow. And then the system is meant to execute the advice that comes in the block behind the whole thing. And in this case, I don't do anything drastically exciting. It's just printing about to call method foo. Yeah, so nothing too fancy here. We can now extend this a little bit with binding parameters to that are valid at a certain point cut and use them in our advices. So what we have for that is means to bind a certain name to a value that occurs. And for example, we can bind to the arguments of a method call. We do that by extending the point cut with another designator that has the syntax that you see here. It's just args with an argument list, so pretty easy. And the thing is, you have to define the name that you give for your arguments beforehand in your actual advice, so that the whole thing looks like that. Now we have got a new doubler, and this doubler is once again hooking before the point cut that follows, and it has another thing. It will be talking about a certain integer with a name. So far, we have not defined where this what the matter is with that integer, but that is to follow. And let's continue with the point cut itself. The point cut is once again the call from before, so it is a call to receiver C with parameter int name foo, return type int. So it's a call site of this type, and this time we will add another point cut designator, and this time we will add the args, and here we bind the integer that we have introduced in the before clause to the argument. And this is referring actually to the argument that we have talked about before. So now we have a name for the argument that is given for this call, and we can work with that within our advice. We can do things to it, like you see here, we can we can change the value, for example, that this thing has. Yeah, we can do pretty amazing stuff for the argument list. We can, for example, select a little bit more in detail how the arguments actually should look like. There's a certain kind of sub-expressions that will work with wildcards or pretty exact specifications of what the parameters should actually look like. But yeah, that's something that you can look up if you need to use it at some point. One thing that we haven't seen so far is, well, advices can not only hook into the state before a certain join point or after a certain join point, but they can also be around a certain join point. In this case, we have an around declarator, and that's that is a little bit special because it introduces a way to pinpoint where the actual method call will then happen. So let's have once again an example. So our doubler is now an around advice, and it talks about a certain parameter value. And what happens in there is that prior to calling to the actual method, we will do something with its parameter. So we will double the I. Then we will proceed with the original control flow. So we will now go inside this call to foo, and we will execute foo. And afterwards, we will catch the return here as a new identifier, and we will remove the doubling from the whole thing by dividing once again. So that's just a play example, toy example here. You don't, in practice, you will do something more useful, but that's just for show, for showing how you can make use of the different particular things that are typical for the around advice. So you have the possibility to hijack results and change them before you return them, and you have ways to intervene before the target method is actually really called, and you can prepare certain things, pre-process the arguments, for example. So that's what the around advice is all about. So now that we know what different advices we have, is what are the actual point cut designators that we can use. So a few of them we have already seen, especially the call one. So the designators for call are the ones that actually are meant to be triggered before the call has been issued. So if you define an advice before a call, you will be with a control flow before point one is actually executed. If you specify it as what was the other one? I think after, then you're after the execution of point two. If you use the designator for execution, you will end up being called before the execution of program point three in this case. And if you use the after one, you will be called after program point four. So that's the difference between call and execution. Apart from that, you have as parameter for this call and execution a certain signature, and that is the static signature of a method. You can specify it in this way. You might also select a constructor. In this case, you don't specify any result type name. Okay. Reality, this might be a little bit tricky, as the following example shows. So in this case, our structure is, I have specified my class. My class has a member method called toString. And we have a main function where we create one of these classes, and then we print out two versions of toString concatenated to each other. So far, nothing too difficult. Let's have a look at the aspect that we are going to consider. So far, we have only had the point cut designator for call and execution. In both cases, we give my class toString as the signature of what we want to intercept. So let's have a look at what the actual advice is all about. Our advice will intervene before certain join points, and the join points that we want to intervene before are either the calls to the toString method or the execution of the toString method that we specified beforehand. So we will actually intervene before, once we call to the method and once we execute the method. And in each case, we will just leave a message that tells us advice has been called. So how many times would you expect the output advice to be done by the whole system? What would you say? So where do they come from? So this one.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you're correct. You will find one times the output for calling toString at that point, and you will also get the execution of my class's toString. For this, it's not this join point, but as soon as this is executed, control flow will jump into the toString from above and will trigger once again. So you will find at least two times advice. So is there any chance that there's another? Okay, your neighbor.
Yeah, we're printing the class of the object C.
So how many?
At least three times. Maybe by concatenating, it's also executed a fourth time. I don't know.
You wanted to say something?
My guess would be four times.
Four times. So there seems to be something unsure about whether the whole thing has three outputs or four outputs. So you're a little bit concerned with something. Internally, what happens is that in these cases, the object that is found there is treated as a plain object, and then the toString is called, and then on the resulting thing, concatenation is executed. So, but that's exactly the problem here, because what we have hooked into is for once, we have hooked into the execution of my classes to string, and that's fine, because thanks to polymorphism, the control flow will in any way reach the execution of the to string method. But I see already some smiles in there, so you probably got the hint. Yeah. Sorry, what? I have to clean away, and which int? That is the return type of the method that you want to select. Or the point code. You wanted to. I heard something there. Well, the point is that, as I said, in the expression above, here we have a conversion to object before we call objects to string method. The thing is now that with this point cut call to string, we have specified that we explicitly want to select calls to my class dot to string. The problem is that internally, of course, yeah, it should be string. You're Yeah, you. I didn't understand you in the. Yeah, of course. That needs to be to string. Needs to be string. That is some copy and paste error. Sorry. You see, that's the problem with fresh slides. You always find something like that. Yeah. Okay. So actually, it should be a string as return type. But the main thing is still the same. In this expression system printl c plus c dot string, we get on the right hand side we get a call call expression that explicitly calls on a receiver type of string because of my class, because we have defined C as my class. But on although internally the same thing happens on the plane C here, what is happening beforehand is that C is casted to an object, and then toString is called. But now there's the static type of the call is then string object toString. And that's why in runtime we will only see three times at twice. So, but you were right to being probably I was too shifty in presenting the whole thing. But yeah, so we will have three times at twice and two times silly me. So you need to be careful when you use these point cuts for call and execution. They actually depend on the static type, and that's especially interesting when you use the call point cut, because there it actually really matters what you do. Yeah.
Do you have any idea why anyone would actually use the call point cut in real applications? Because it doesn't seem like something you really want to do.
I think. Well, it's just there because it it works. Yeah, its use is discouraged on the official documentation, but yeah, you can. Well, think back to the times when we have talked about dispatching and static types of some things. You might want to use the whole system to implement some other concept, like probably multiple dispatching or something like that. And in this case, you might want to match exactly calls of a certain signature and then do something with that. So that might be an application. So, yeah. But that's same thing as with all the other approaches. I'm not really actively programming them, so I can't really tell you why you would really want to do that. Okay, we can continue on, probably hurry a little bit because time is running fast. And yeah, the next thing is field-related designators. So there's the get and set expressions that you can do, and you'll find an example for that. So it's not so difficult to imagine point cuts and advices for that. The only thing that's probably a little bit interesting is that you, especially for the set, you might want to intercept the value that is bound to be set to the field, and you can also do that with an args designator. So, yeah, I think that's not too difficult. It's just another method type designator. Then there are other designators that are type-based, so you can concatenate to your conditional point cut, for example, conditions about the target or the type of the class to which the in whose boundaries we are actually currently in. So that's the within. And yeah, so that's type-based things that can be attached to your point cuts. Then there's also flow-based and state-based things like the cflow and the if, With the cflow, you will select all the join points, and really all join points that are occurring between the start and the end of the join point that you are mentioning, start and the end of the point cut you are mentioning within its parameter. What does that mean? For example, you can specify cflow for method f, and with that you select all possible join points that are reached between the beginning of point cut that belongs to f and the end of the point cut that becomes that belongs to f. That means that you will select before the executions of f, before the calls of g and h, before the executions of g, the end of g, the call to h, and so on. So all the join points that are hidden in the during the control flow that happens between the start of this call to f and the end of this call to f are the ones that we will select with this cflow thing. That alone seems a little bit crazy, but you can attach other conditions to that that specify more clearly on which of the point cuts that, on which of the join points that are happening between the start and the end of the cflow one you want to concentrate. So you could, for example, add call to h or something, and then you would only select this call to h and this call to h. So that you would restrict yourself to only two matching things. So these cflow things are clearly meant to be specified further and are kind of meant to express that there has been something happening in the call history of your join point. So that's cflow. And same as cflow, you can also kind of freely specify conditions in plain Java with your if thing. And yeah, for example, the one that if done at the bottom, that's one really inefficient way of selecting every call. So yeah, this guarded setter is an aspect that will intervene before a kind of join point is reached, and which one I want to select is expressed via an if clause. And this is some valid code that every time that a possible join point happens, it tests whether the kind of this join point is actually a call join point. So this one will execute at every join point that is valid, execute this test whether the name of the join point is actually a call. So that is a very inefficient way of of matching calls. But you can, well, this is also clearly meant to be additional condition for some other point cut, and can you can use that to make it more precise, to introduce a new condition why you want to match at a certain join point. Okay, that's the flow and state based things. Other things you might want to care about is as these are systems that are aspects are also kind of modular, you can combine several aspects in the project. You might want to take care of that you have a clear semantics on which of the aspects is actually served first. And there is a certain specification on which aspect has precedence over another one, and that's the rule set from there. But I won't actually really focus on the concrete ways how advices are preferred to each other. There is a rule set, and you can look that up, and that's enough for me in this context. What's more interesting to me is the implementation of the whole thing. So how is an aspect weaver actually working? What is the semantics of the ways of different kinds of advices that we have seen and the different point cuts that we've seen? And yeah, generally for the implementation, there's different concepts on how you can make your system behave the way that you have specified it with aspect J. And there's, for example, the old wave with a preprocessor that is, was the ancient aspect-oriented beginnings. So the system would transform on the source code level and produce these things that you have seen with a pink background on one of the very first slides. Aspect-oriented programming is not only limited to just Java code. For almost all the mainstream languages, there's some dialect that is aspect rather than dealing with aspect orientation, and some of these approaches might still work via some kind of pre-processing on the source code. So that's probably not done yet for all the approaches. So the other part is that you might hook into the compilation of your compiler in case that it offers some kind of access to its internals. Then you could do all the aspect weaving during compilation. Then there's the post-compilation processor that will just take the, in the Java world, will take the bytecode and rewrite that. Then there's the possibility of rewriting your bytecode on the fly during the runtime of some kind of a virtual machine, for example, or during class loader execution, or any combination of the methods that I've mentioned so far. So that's all things that have been done with aspect-oriented systems so far. And what in detail is the things that were meant to be achieved? So in case of aspect J, we will end up with kind of woven JVM code where the aspects are transported to the locations, to the program points where they actually apply. And for the very simple aspects, for example, this one here, where we just want to intercept a set on a certain attribute. Well, for example, that's something that applies here, and that can be done directly by inlining the relevant advice. So what we want to inline here is a call to system.outprintln, and in bytecode that just looks like, well, you will find the put field at the very end, and beforehand the system will at first get a connection to my aspect classed object, that is the one that carries the aspect's actual code. So this system out println actually hides in an object of class my aspect, and will be called here. So yeah, it's just called from the woven JVM code. If we have combinations with any conditions, for example, on the type of of the receiver, then what is done is actually there will be guards inserted into the woven JVM code, and it will jump over the actual advice call in case that it is not really relevant for this point. So we'll jump on to the continue spot where the call to the aspects method is actually not executed. So nothing too exciting here. What is more exciting is the translation of around and proceed, especially when there's point cut parameters. Because, well, you need to keep in mind that proceed is something that is now that is appearing as kind of some keyword, some static thing like super, but it actually needs to be resolved in a dynamic way. And that is the example from above, where we have the doubler once again, and in case that we need to apply this doubler, this whenever we call a foo method. Let's have a look at this foo method. And in this case, what the system would do is, well, it would introduce a certain special method that is called instead of the foo method, where all the around advice is actually executed, and the proceed will be replaced with a special other name. Can anyone imagine why it is not directly foo here? Well, that has been proceed before. So proceed should actually, in this case, match with foo and should then call foo. But in this case, we have another indirection in there. Well, it's something that you cannot directly see here, but the system is kind of prepared for the case that you introduce several aspects, and you might have several aspects matching a certain join point. And in this case, you need to be able to kind of execute your advices in a chain. And in these cases, the system prepares this around body to call not to the foo directly, but to another advice, and only then go further to foo. So there's possibilities to daisy chain several advices after each other. Once again, the pink code is something that I have decompiled from things that the aspect J system has generated. And with decompiled, I mean, I sat there during the afternoon and figured out what it would do. Yeah, so next thing is that you need to keep in mind is that, well, the around proceed system is something that is even more challenging, considering that within an advice you can use plain Java code. Plain Java code also means that you can also specify inline classes and anonymous classes, and you can also use this proceed expression inside these anonymous classes. And these anonymous classes, these classes might end up creating objects that might escape the scope of the advice. What does that mean? That means that you in a pretty simple case where just method F might be called, just this system how it is before, you might end up with a situation where this you intercept the whole system before the execution of for the call of F, and you can still kind of call this F through the proceed expression, but this proceed expression might be used in an internal class somewhere and might be tucked away in an object like this, and might be stored at some static context or some other place where it rests and is not yet called in any way. So the system goes on. Control flow leaves the advice execution and goes somewhere else. And at some other point, we might reach a program point where we access this object where we have stored our reference to proceed. And only then our method f is called. And even more, this method f might have need references to some parameters or something that are long gone, that have existed during the call over here, but as control flow has gone and went on, well, we might have destroyed the whole local variable set, and that looks like a problem that is, well, kind of familiar. People who have has anyone had any experiences with virtual machines from our chair lecture? Nobody? Well, or you might also have had some deeper insights into functional programming. There's this thing that is called closure, and closure is something that keeps the environment for a certain method execution. And this situation here smells strongly for the need for such a closure. And that's actually also what is done in reality. So in the case, let's have a look at where that might apply. We have a case where we have once again our foo method, and a place where we where the foo method should be intercepted with an around expression. So foos are now intercepted with around. In this case, our proceed goes into a special thing called a closure, or a callable, as it is in Java. So proceed is not actually executed at this point here, but it is stored inside this callable C. So it is compiled into some kind of executable code, and this is submitted to some external static context. So the executor, that is some Java facility for having a set of threads that are active all the time, and as soon as you have something to do that you need to do asynchronously, you can submit it to the executor set, and someone will take care of the execution of your thing. So that's what the executor submit is all about. And meanwhile, you return with some kind of approximate value for your method. And later on, you offer access to the exact computation that your intercepted method has actually done, and you can do that via the get on the future that is filled from your foo method. So that is a way how the execution of the intercepted method actually escapes its original calling context and ends up being somewhere else. And this also means that the objects that this call is defined on actually survive as long as that. And this can only be done by introducing several concepts, for example, the shadow classes and the closures. The shadow class is the thing that is that contains the actual advice code. So that is one thing that is carrying the actual advice and called in the end. And the other thing that is provided is the things that are parameters for our call, for our proceed call we need later on, and that is the receiver object and also the parameter. So once again, this is code that I have disassembled manually, so that's why it is pink. And that's in concept what is happening in there. We have a list of parameters where we find the receiver and the first parameter, and we give that to our we create a new closure from that. Here we give it, or we provide it with the parameters, then we give the closure to the actual advice method, and that is the shadow class as well as the actual closure. And there's a lot of things inside there. The things that you should take away of is that the proceed is is in there as a kind of static method, and what it does is it gets the parameters and gives them to run, which is a method of the closure C. That is the around closure that we have generated from above, and that was given to the execution of the advice method. And inside the around closure is something that we have here, the run method then will actually call the foo around body, which is the thing that we have seen in the in the beginning of the implementations chapter, that actually does the call to the foo method back then. So that's how the whole system works together. So what it does is it creates a closure where it stores all the necessary parameters, and this thing can be tucked away somewhere, and as there are still references on the parameters, the garbage collector won't destroy the things, and we can still use them later on when we want to actually perform our call to the thing that needs to be preceded. Okay. Even more, things like the cflow thing that is based on the execution context, or a basis, a point cut on its execution context, is something that's really messy to implement, especially as you might imagine that for such a complicated point cut like the one here, we need to, every time that we want to evaluate whether the actual join point is matching this point cut, we need to have a look at the runtime stack and check whether at some point a call to method f with the parameter int has happened, and that there's been something going on with the argument. So that is something that is really running with poor runtime speed when you implement it naively, but there's a lot of has been a lot of work going on optimizing things like that. So there's ideas for introducing a kind of shadow stack where you keep track of the state of your control flow run, and where you can check with a quick glance whether the cflow property is fulfilled or not. And there's even more work on optimizations in practice. You can share different states of your shadow stack. You can introduce counters for certain conditions, or you might also do away with any stack or state thing by just using static analysis. In a few cases, you can statically prove that certain conditions will definitely be fulfilled for certain join points, so you don't need to test at all. So these are all creative and intellectually quite challenging ways of handling or dealing with aspects and point cut matching. And yeah, I think there's a lot of opportunity for nice papers there. So in summary, the translation scheme has a few implications. We have seen how before after advice, and also around advice is actually implemented. Join points need sometimes dispatching wrappers and something. There's for dynamic dispatching, you might also need runtime tests in order to get the right join points, and flow sensitive point cuts are something that is costly when you do it in the naive way, but there's ways to optimize that. Don't even get me started on the if point cut designator. That's something that's even more horrible. Yeah, in summary, aspect orientation, it gives you a lot, like untangling of concerns. You can extend your object structure and methods kind of late, so to say. You can bundle them all together just on the basis of that the concept is the same. And yeah, that's kind of introducing another level of abstraction that deals with structures where you would otherwise smear your common shared aspect around everything. So yeah, that's what makes aspect orientation attractive. Of course, there's also things that are not so nice about aspect orientation. The weaving might introduce a lot of overhead, especially when you use some kind of advanced point cuts that are flow sensitive or computation heavy, like the if or the cflow, so that generates runtime overhead. Especially if you use something like these aspect orientation approaches without any IDE support, you might get really confused about the control flow of your programs, because there's just things happening that you cannot really see in your original code anymore. Of course, IDE support helps you a lot, because it kind of marks all the join points that it sees as potentially matching some point cut somewhere else, and you can click on that and just jump to the point cut. And the other thing that you need to keep in mind is that debugging is also very hard, because you actually execute code that is drastically different from the source code, and without any IDE support, you won't get the correspondence between where your executed code is and what your actual sources have been. So that's something that might be in contra of aspect orientation, but if you have the IDE support, then well, why not? So if you're now interested in aspect orientation, you should have a look at the sources here. What I haven't mentioned here is the online documentation for AspectJ, but I'm sure that you will be able to find that somewhere on the internet. There's magical things like Google that help you on that. So yeah, that's all from my side. And I hope you had fun with concepts for creating modules in software. And I hope that your expectations on programming languages have been fulfilled, at least at a certain part. And yeah, I wish you good luck in your exam. We'll see us in 2 days when we have the opportunity to talk about the exam. And yeah, apart from that, I wish you a good time and good luck in the exam. Thank you.